I realise that of late I've talked rather more about economics than I have about politics, philosophy, or socio-cultural issues. But some of the points I've been making, I think, need to be made and understood. It is an inescapable fact of life that feeds into everything else. In this video, I want to focus on how, despite the fact that government controls virtually always make life worse for consumers, gullible members of the public and opportunistic politicians will virtually always vote for passing them. But first, I want to tell a little story. When I was a kid, I was very much into dinosaurs. In fact, my dream at that age was to become a professor of paleontology. Well, I got the right profession, but the wrong discipline. Anyway, I would spend a lot of time in the local library reading books on natural history and taxonomy and things like that. And one day, I spotted this rather odd volume nestled among the others. And it wasn't about creatures who lived millions of years ago, but rather it was an artist's projections of how he thinks animals and mankind might exist and how they might look in the future. Now, this book stayed with me. Its images were nightmarish, fat blob creatures manufactured for meat, little ant men riding some weird creature or other, sloth men, and so on and so forth. But I could never remember what this book was called, or indeed who wrote it. And, you know, I'd find myself thinking about it once in a while, but I never was able to track it down. But then, the other day, my brother discovered what it was called, and he tipped me off. The book was called Man After Man by Douglas Dixon. Now, as something of a collector of books, of course, I immediately took to Amazon. That's right. The going rate for this book is £108.74 in hardback and almost £250 in paperback. What madness is this? Surely this book cannot be worth this much, can it? Are these booksellers greedy and money-grabbing so-and-sos like Gary Lineker? Actually, as I'm sure most of you already know, this is simple supply and demand in action. Why is this book £108? Well, it looks like it only had a single print run in 1990, so there's only one edition. And that means that the total number of copies of this book out there is low. In other words, the supply is restricted. And, as I have discovered since finding out what this book was called, there is a burgeoning interest online for something called speculative evolution. And this interest is big enough to support its own fan pages and communities. And it just so happens that Douglas Dixon is one of the key early pioneers of this form. So, not only is the supply of this book restricted, but the demand for it has been increasing. And that's how something that might have cost £15 once upon a time now costs 10 times that price. As an aside, this simple fact alone makes a total mockery of Karl Marx's labour theory of value. Let's say the Amazon seller is selling the book second-hand. Does that mean he's exploiting the labour of the original bookstore or the publisher who produced, distributed and advertised the book? I mean, who exactly is being exploited in this event where the person selling this book makes an almost certain 90% plus markup by selling Man After Man through Amazon? I bet you anything the Marxists won't be able to answer that one. Let's see Democratic Socialist 01, Finnish Bolshevik or Circe bother to make a reply video on this. I bet you they will not. Anyway, this simple rule of price simply being a reflection of the underlying realities of supply and demand does not change if you introduce government-mandated regulations into the mix. And this chiefly is what I wanted to talk to you about today. Because in almost every case when this has happened, it has led to consumers paying more for products and having less choice. In other words, it has promoted monopoly conditions which drive up prices rather than free market competition which drives down prices. Now, this can happen in a lot of different ways, some of which are less obvious than others, and I want to go through just three of them here. The first is price fixing. This is simply where a good, let's say for example apples, seems to the average person to be priced too high to be justified. People will not see the price as a reflection of market forces, but rather they will jump to a moral conclusion, reasoning that the price can only be this high because of the deliberate and malign intentions on the part of the seller. In this scenario, we might expect to see widespread moral outrage and eventually even political crusading in order to get the price of the product reduced by government mandate. Now, regardless of the actual reasons for the price of this particular product being so high, if you are a politician, whether already in power or trying to get elected to power, it is in your interest to be seen to do something about this. The public are angry, and regardless of whether they are correct in their anger, something must be done. This is why politicians will almost always be incentivized to intervene rather than do nothing, because it is politically better to be seen to do something than to do nothing. Note that the actual consequences of whatever policy they end up passing don't matter in the slightest. Why? Because by then you can either paint it as a different set of circumstances, or more likely, it's a different set of politicians now tasked with dealing with the fallout. This is how, over many years, successive governments have been able to build clusterfuck policies on top of each other without ever truly being called out on it. Of course, there is never any shortage of useful idiots around to tell politicians, the public, and the media what they want to hear. This is how we even end up with leftist economists in the first place. They have their own supply and demand calculations to respond to, and since there's a demand for a Paul Krugman useful idiot-shaped hole, it follows indeed that we get a Paul Krugman. Make no bones about it, he's serving his own economic interests while serving the political interests of whoever needs him. So anyway, what happens when they pass the price fix on our apples? Assuming that the underlying realities that led to the apple prices being so high in the first place haven't really changed, all it means is that the existing stock of apples is bought very quickly by the people who can get to them first, and you are still left with a large quantity of people who don't have apples. However, it is likely that the original high price of apples was because apple producers could only make a profit at that high rate. So the new low price point of apples would, even if they sold out their entire stock, result in a loss for them. So in this scenario, apple producers would either end up going bust or they simply get out of the apple trade. And now the apple shortage has actually been worsened. Now, in the real world, it's unlikely that we'd see this scenario play out in the apple market, but very similar effects have been seen in other markets. Take housing, for example, which in most people's perception is much more important than apples. The left talk about such things as the right to affordable housing, and so because they believe that every person should be entitled to live somewhere at a price point they can afford, measures like rent controls become very attractive both to the voter and to the politician trying to get their votes. But in practice, the effect of price fixing in ground rents is exactly the same as the effect of price fixing for apples. Building constructors, not willing to operate at a loss, are pushed out of building cheap housing and switch instead to the much more lucrative luxury housing market. Landlords, not willing to front the costs of operating buildings at such low rents, have every incentive to sell their properties. And on top of it all, the new low cost of rents drives up demand for housing, because now more people expect to have access to housing at the new low price point. So the price fix has the twin effect of increasing demand while reducing supply, and the net effect is, of course, a shortage. In his book, Basic Economics, Thomas Sowell lists many examples of these effects of rent controls playing out in the real world, for example, in San Francisco, New York, and especially in Sweden across the 70s, 80s, and 90s. I mean, the evidence is damning. I don't believe anybody could believe in, you know, rent controls after reading these things. You're idiots! The second thing is licensing laws. In a free market, ideally, the barriers to starting up a new company and entering open competition should be low. And a noted effect of open competition is that it leads toward driving prices down overall. Why? Because a fundamental law of economics is that, all other things being equal, given a choice of two identical products, people will buy the cheaper of the two. For example, if you went to a restaurant and a waiter said, you can have a Coke for £2 or a Pepsi for £1, unless you really, really hated Pepsi or really, really loved Coke, you will likely go for the Pepsi. In the real world, this is seldom allowed to happen. To demonstrate, I will refer to a film from 1963 called Carry On Cabby. In this classic comedy caper, Sid James plays Charlie Hawkins, the owner of a taxi firm, who ends up falling out with his wife Peggy, played, of course, by the inimitable Hattie Jakes. Because he seems to spend more time and attention on the taxi firm than he does on her. And the crunch point comes when he ends up missing their 15th wedding anniversary because he's out doing a cab job. And naturally, Peggy is not only upset, she's absolutely livid. To get her own back, she launches her own taxi firm of cabs exclusively driven by women. In the film, two things happen. First, the unique selling point of the taxis being driven by sexy women as opposed to gruff old men leads customers to prefer their cabs to the original company. Second, Peggy then undercuts Charlie, so any customers not bowled over by the female taxi drivers are won over by the lower price. And you can see where this goes. Charlie is driven to the brink of bankruptcy and has to beg his wife for forgiveness and to lay off him. It's a pretty funny film. Now, in the real world, what has tended to happen is that rather than begging his competitor to lay off him, what Charlie would have done is lobbied the local government of the city to introduce some sort of restriction to stop this scenario from happening. Perhaps it becomes an issue for the taxi drivers' union, and then it becomes a matter of moral concern. You can imagine the sort of arguments they'd come out with. They're going to put us out of a job, the union will cry. Why isn't anyone doing something about it? And because they will cry the loudest, their voices are more likely to be heard by the media, and therefore by the public, and therefore, most crucially, by the politicians. Of course, Charlie could try to innovate or compete or drop down his prices, but you'd be surprised at how often this does not occur to people who are set in their ways. And so, of course, what happens is that the government mandates a limited number of taxi licenses. So now you can't drive a taxi or indeed start a taxi firm until you have ticked all the right regulatory boxes. What are the actual effects of this? The government has now artificially restricted the total supply of possible taxi drivers and indeed the total number of firms operating in the city. And effectively now, the existing taxi firms are protected from the likes of a Peggy Hawkins starting up her own rogue outfit. And the result? Well, protection of existing taxi firms and artificially high prices for customers using those cabs. The government has effectively helped to create cartel conditions, and thousands of people who may have used cabs at lower prices are now priced out of using them at all. The third thing I'm going to look at here is subsidies. Licensing is only one way in which firms can attempt to weasel out of competing in the open market. Another is through government handouts, also known as subsidies. Where licensing works to protect existing firms from new competition by artificially reducing the supply of said competition, subsidies work by artificially reducing the operating costs of a particular firm with taxpayer money. There is a long history of this sort of protectionism in the United States, especially farm subsidies, which seem especially prevalent. Now, in my view, this sort of thing is absolutely pathetic. If you can't compete in the open market, then just get out of it. Again, in Basic Economics, which is a great guide for these sorts of things, Thomas Sowell points out a great example. One of the factors in California's periodic water crises, for example, is that the California farmers' use of water is subsidized so heavily that its price to farmers is less than 1% of what the same amount of water costs to people living in Los Angeles or San Francisco. The net result is that agriculture, which accounts for about 3% of the state's output, consumes more than 4/5 of its water. 4/5. Another consequence of subsidized water is that farmers grow crops requiring great amounts of water, such as rice and cotton. In California's semi-desert climate, where such crops would never be grown if farmers had to pay the real costs of water they use, inspiring as it may be to some that California's arid lands have been enabled to produce vast amounts of fruits and vegetables with the aid of subsidized water, those same fruits and vegetables could be produced much more cheaply elsewhere with water supplied free of charge from the clouds. The way to tell whether the California produce is worth what it costs to grow is to allow all of the costs to be paid by the California farmers themselves, who compete with farmers in other states that have higher rainfall levels. There is no need for government officials to decide arbitrarily and categorically whether it is a good thing or a bad thing for particular crops to be grown in California with water artificially supplied from federal irrigation projects. Such questions can be decided incrementally through price competition in a free market. So here, by making water almost free for farmers, they have greatly distorted the demand for water from farmers, who no longer have to worry about that as a cost. The cost is being carried, note, just not by them. It's being levied on everyone else in the state for their benefit. Now, this might well mean that those farms are producing crops at a cheaper price point than they might otherwise, but this price is a distortion. The costs are coming out somewhere else in the economy, and those farmers have weaseled out of competing in a fair and open market because other farmers do have to take the price of water into account. Even if the farmers of California can show that they are making money on paper, the real amount that they should be making is obviously less than they are, because the true margin should take the costs of the water into account. So you see, even when the government intervenes in these seemingly small ways by writing off the costs of water for farmers, there's still no getting around supply and demand. It's only ever a trade-off, and the costs are simply handed off to some other third party. This is one reason why I believe that government can provide practically no solutions to these problems. They can only cause further problems. If the markets are allowed to take their own course, then the customer ends up the better off for it, with cheaper goods. And the customer almost certainly doesn't end up footing the bill for Charlie's tax firm or Jim the Californian farmer. You might say, but yes, if we listen to you, academic agent, Charlie's taxi firm would go under, and those Californian farms would go out of business too. To which my answer is, well, if you can't take the heat, get out of the kitchen. Maybe it's right that an arid region shouldn't have farms. Maybe a taxi owner unwilling to respond to new market conditions should just get out of the business. I talked about dinosaurs at the start of this video, and this is just like evolution. If you don't adapt, what worked yesterday won't work today, and you face extinction. And a new creature, supremely adapted to the current environment, will take over. Why are leftists so frightened of the laws of nature? Why do you seek to protect Charlie? Charlie has no right to stay in business if he refuses to adapt. Now, there are many other ways that government can interfere with the natural markets: antitrust laws, wage fixes, tariffs against foreign firms, quotas limiting how much can be produced. But hopefully by this point you get the picture. All of these measures result in the same perverse distortion of the natural order of things, which lead to higher prices for consumers while rewarding the cowardice and inflexibility of existing firms, who, rather than improve their own services, instead went crying to the public, the media, or to a politician, who, of course, were only too happy to be seen to help them.